Welcome to Betting People, but with a twist. Usually the man on your screen would be interviewing a range of big names and big punters from the racing world, but today I, William Gajali, am interviewing the interviewer's master, Simon Knott. Simon, thank you for inviting me here.
Thank you, William. Thank you.
Right, so...
Boots on the other foot.
Indeed. And what a big boot to wear, because looking through... before you got into racing, before you started interviewing, it's a fascinating backstory. You went traveling, and you used to be a real punk rocker, because I can see all of the CDs behind you. Talk to us a bit about your music first of all.
It's just my love, apart from the racing, really. I've always been into music in one form or another, and started getting involved listening when I could first afford to buy sort of records to begin with, and I got involved with travelling around with a few bands and trying to promote a few things in local pubs, that sort of stuff. So yeah, and I'm still collecting now. I love all the 50s, 60s, that sort of obscurity 70s punk I grew up with. I was 12 years old when God Save the Queen came out. We used to sit and wait and hope that the radio presenter would make a mistake and play it because it was banned, that sort of thing, you know. And then Elvis died, so all the rock and roll suddenly became more acceptable. So yeah, so I love music. That's my passion apart from the racing.
Were you in any bands when you were younger?
No, I'm not. I've got a double bass and a guitar, which I can play barely. I'm more of a fan than a practitioner.
Speaking also about your past, you went on a fair bit of travelling. You've been here, there and everywhere, not just down under, but also you've been to the Far East. You've seen, I think, sort of big international races as well. Tell us about your first travels to Australia.
Well, I had a bit of a wobble in my 30s. I decided to sell everything, which wasn't much, and took off the day after the Gold Cup in 2000. Me and a mate flew off to Singapore. I was racing at Kranji the next night. Travelled around Thailand for a bit, and then went to Australia. I was just turned up early days of the internet, and somebody said, if you're ever in Sydney, give me a call. I gave him a call, and he was quite surprised I had. Went to his place, turned out his girlfriend was in Home and Away, so sort of hanging around with the Home and Away people. And he was in a band, so I was basically doing band stuff all the time, going to gigs every night. Got a bit of work over there, and went to the Melbourne Cup with a brew on it, and it was sponsored by Foster's. I should have backed it, shouldn't I? But I didn't, obviously.
What was international racing like in those days? Because now, obviously, it's a normal given thing. People go all the time from here. Back in those days, could you notice any differences between then and now?
Well, to be honest, it doesn't seem that long ago, even though it was, 19 years ago now. The main thing, it was just open at 7:30 in the morning, and I'd got the overnight train down from Sydney to Melbourne, and I arranged to meet a bookie, naively, from the local West Country bookie, John Tovey, and I said, I'll meet you in the nearest bar to the bookies, thinking it was going to be like in the UK. Well, there's bars with bookies in, there's bookies all over the place, so we never, even though he was there, we didn't actually bump into each other, so... that was a thing. And also ladies queuing up for the men's toilets was the first time I'd seen that, but that's quite common over here now as well. So it was a brilliant. The Melbourne Cup is something else. I mean, I'd love to go again at one point, but it's a party from morning till night,
Did you ever go to Japan when you were...
No, I went racing in Thailand, went to the Bangkok Race Club in Thailand, which I don't think is actually there anymore. And just the Melbourne Cup. So that was the two. I've been told when I went to India, I went to went racing in Bangalore and Mumbai as well. And that was quite interesting because it was in January, and a lot of the UK jockeys were riding over there, Paul Edry, people like that. So that was quite it's like a bit old colonial throwback sort of thing in those race courses.
Now, after those travels, when you came back, you arrived just in time for the Cheltenham Festival. What luck you thought, but things didn't work out that way.
Yeah, just in time for the foot and mouth. So I was absolutely potless, came back until the... every day I went to the cash machine in Thailand where I was staying, And I knew that the one day it refused to give me any more money, I'd have to come back. So I did. And I was hoping to come straight back in a few quid with the Cheltenham Festival. That was off the foot and mouth. So I ended up working in a perfume factory, putting stickers on bottles, because of course I got no qualifications. So can't do anything apart from what I knew, which was racing. So I learnt what boredom was for a couple of months.
Any particular brand of perfume? You think you're saying before it was Jo Malone, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. They used to make miniatures for hotels and things like that. Thing, but yeah, that was pretty mind-numbing. I've done some mind-numbing jobs in my time, and that was one of them.
So when racing returned, eventually after foot and mouth, what did you find yourself doing? What did you get into?
I went back with Dave Phillips originally, who's the bookie I worked for before I left in time for Royal Ascot. And then I started working for Ivor Perry at the end of the summer full-time. So then it was, he was recently died, poor Ivor, but he was a Dorset farmer, and his daughter and son-in-law just taken over the business. They were looking for a full-time member of staff. So I worked for them on a self-employed basis, but we were going racing, averaging 18, 20 days a month around the local apps, as far as sort of Worcester, Hereford, those sort of places. So yeah, it was great time. For 8 years I worked for them.
And with also, you know, your first job there, how exactly did you, I mean, you've been working for them before, but what exactly was the sort of big chance you took that allowed you to go full time with them?
What, racecourse bookies?
Yeah, or, yeah.
I've just left the army, and I used to go racing, you know, when I could, but not that regularly. The local pub we used to drink out the Boar's Head, the landlord there used to work for bookies, and he taught me tip tack before I'd ever been racing. So I learnt the tip tack. And I used to go and sort of watch. He'd work with a floor man every now and again as a floor man. And I got a phone call one day, wanted to play Skittles. And he said, can you go and work with Jack Lynn at Taunton? So I knew roughly what to do, so I went there. The very first bet they took, a lady came up, they had 500 quid on one at 4-5. And I looked, and Eddie Baxter, he used to trade his Avalon, he went 9-10, which is quite unusual at the time, but I said, he's 9-10 up there. So the bookie opted off the still with a 450-500 back. They'd made 50 quid for nothing. And he said, you've earned this money with the first words you spoke, you're on the firm. So then from then I was like the third man. When they couldn't get anybody else, I used to go with them. So that was 89, and that's where it started. Jack Lynn for 5-6 years.
What's the most vivid racecourse memory that you've got working on the pitches? Because as I understand it, you were there for the Magnificent Seven.
Yes, and that probably would be the most vivid memory, because I think my boss said, you know, we could see it all unfolding, and my boss said, we'll stick up 3-1 or whatever it was. He said some mug might back it straight away. Somebody straight in one of the firms, £500 or something, which was quite big for our firm at the time. He lost the most money he's ever lost in the race course, but we all cheered. We all cheered Frankie home, because we knew that it was, you know, it was something special that we were witnessing, and you know, he'd get the money back. And incidentally, Ivor Perry, I worked for his horse, came fourth in that race. I've said, I can't remember what it's called now, but it was fourth. So that was an interesting sort of connection there. But that was amazing. And actually, before racing, I think Tomo was interviewing Frankie Dettori, and Dettori said positive things about all his rides. Of course, I was far too professional to have gone and do a multiple, but I should have done
the ones that got away. Right, so you got to spend a lot of time on the rails, obviously, and now you're sort of in the newer era of racing where a lot of stuff is done digitally, a lot of stuff is done online. Do you think that you know, those on the pitches now have the same amount of skill as, you know, your Ivor Perry's would you need to in those days, as you would have needed to in those days, especially with the advent of the internet and the exchanges and everything?
Well, I mean, it's you can't even compare it now, because my job was a floor man, and the floor man is basically redundant these days. What the floor man did was stand in front of the bookies and watch all the other bookies. So you were in contact with your boss, you watch all the prices, you had to be alert all the time. You couldn't miss anything. If it's 6-4 everywhere and one person went 7-4, you might go 7-4 in a place, and they would decide if they wanted to go 7-4 or not. Or alternatively, you saw price collapsing, you'd show on the thumb. You know, and then it would be dashing around. If they laid a big bet, they would sort of ask you to go and have a hedge bet, which was great fun. You know, if they laid, my boss was quite a small layer, the first one. So they might ask you to go and have a 214 back with the fractions. You're rushing around. You call the bet in to the bookmaker. Just word of mouth. You didn't have, you know, they just rolled it in. You paid after the race all collected. That was brilliant fun. And the hustle and bustle, floor men running around everywhere. You had to know faces. So you got to know who was a mate of a certain trainer, who was a professional punter. You know, all that sort of local knowledge was invaluable, you know, for your boss. So the more you knew, the more valuable you were to be employed. And also, the market did make the odds. And sometimes some bookmakers would stick their necks out and try and get one in they didn't fancy. A lot of them had card markers of people's opinions. Brilliant fun. These days, obviously, you know, the exchanges do sort of dictate things, and a lot of the floor man's gone. The exchanges are the floor man these days. The computer flashes up if the price is near the knuckle where it's starting to go. A lot of the fun's gone out of it, a lot of the excitement's gone out of it, and a lot of the cash punters, nearly all the professionals used to come racing. You know, they would be having the bets on. You'd have big cash punters, and sometimes small punters, small bets were very significant. You know, there'd be somebody that'd have a fiver on a certain trainer's horse, and if they did, everybody used to hop off their stool and have their own bet. So all that, the fun of it, it was just like a maelstrom for 10-15 minutes between each race where it was all going off. And it was brilliant, so much fun. I absolutely loved it, and that's why I still persevere trying to promote the betting ring, even though we never get those days back.
Can you give us a really memorable bet that somebody had with you when one of those big hustle and bustle days?
Well, the most memorable bet wasn't even a hustle bustle. It was a midweek at Salisbury. I think it was probably firm going. There was a two horse race and we'd gone 13-2 on. Guys come up and he's wanted 13,000 on to win $2,000. This is with the Perrys, and they've laid him 6,500 to 1 on. You know, you can turn them down, and it's one half the track, you know. And funnily enough, the guy afterwards said he was betting for the injured jockeys fund. I'm sure he's a fantasist, but that's the story he told us. So, you know, so think what he will about that. But yeah, that was the most interesting.
And one thing with the floor man, that's, you know, I'm a much younger person here, so forgive me for asking, but all these bookies in the same ring with their own floor man, seeing each other, you know, lay these bets and go and try and hedge their positions. Did you ever have people, I mean, there's a lot of camaraderie in the ring, but did you ever have particular bookies that, you know, you'd be happier to go to hedge your bets first, that you know you'd get a sort of better price or better deal from?
Yeah, everybody knew, not the pecking order, but everybody knew the size of the bookie. So they all knew the one I worked with. There's no point asking him for a £3,000 bet, but you knew where to go. I mean, Stephen Little in the ring would lay any bet you liked. Mm. He'd turn up in his mink coat and he's driving in his Bentley to Taunton, places like that. Mm. And there was also some that would give you the bluff a bit. They didn't really want to take a back bet. Because if they take a back bet, they know they've done it wrong, really. So what they would do, you get the bluff. So they'd look over the top of your head and you'd be saying 200-1. And then he'd go, oh, sorry, what was that? And then he would point to some guy down there. And so I've just laid it to this fella. And you'd get nothing. So you'd sort of get to know the ones that would give you the bluff every now and again. So yeah, that was part of the job as well, knowing which ones to ask for a bet and which ones might give you the bluff. So my boss used to say, all big bets bluffed. He didn't want them coming in even trying. So it was like,
right, thank you very much for that part one. And in part two, we'll go on to racing in the modern era. So we're talking about your experiences in the betting ring previously. Let's talk about racing more broadly now. Racing's sort of at a crossroads where, you know, it's still the second best attended spectator sport in Britain, but a lot of people worry about the sport's future. I mean, is there anything you think that the higher-ups in racing should be doing differently to make the sport more engaging?
I think that the racing should employ a really high-profile PR company, and not an in-house thing that's run by somebody that knows somebody in racing, but a real, I mean, racing's got everything. It's got glamour, it's got colour, it's got money, it's got excitement. You've got a cross range of the whole spectrum of society that enjoy it. I mean, it should be a PR person's or an advertising agency's absolute dream of a sport to try and publicise. And I just don't think it is publicised well enough. Everybody's trying to do their own little bit. So, you know, publicise your own companies, or, you know, and there's some great social media and that out there, but I think a real put some real money into it and get, you know, try and show people how fantastic is the shop windows that are out there. You know, Glorious Goodwood, Royal Ascot, Cheltenham. I've never taken anybody racing, even to, you know, the local tracks, which that hasn't enjoyed it. But race gets a negative thing with the stigma these days about gambling. And, you know, I mean, there's such a great product to sell out there, and there's such a potential audience that from the outside, we're all in Bova racing. So it's normal to us, and we can't understand why people, but people don't even know anything about racing. You know, you say, what do you do? And you tell them I work for a bookmaker, they quite often glaze over. Mm. Or if you say racing, what they used to say, oh, you know that guy with the sideburns. You know, that would be their extent, or the Grand National. You know, I think we're such an insular sport, and in a certain extent, that we assume that everybody knows about it, but in reality, the vast majority of people don't know about it. And I think it would be something that could be easily sold if it was put in the right sort of publicity hands, which I don't think is done.
I think many people there would agree with you. Would you change anything in terms of sort of how race days are run? Lots of people come up with ideas for, you know, making the experience cheaper. Do you think it costs too much to get into courses these days?
Well, I don't go racing as much as I used to during the week anymore. And to be honest, I never really had to pay much myself, because it always with the bookmakers. I mean, that's one thing. They make the bookmakers pay to go in, which I always found that to be, you know, amazing. They're all part of the attraction. I don't think race courses realise that the race course bookies are part of the attraction for people that go racing, and that, you know, they're a dwindling breed now. And if they stop, race course bookmakers stop going, I think a lot of race goers will stop going, but I don't think the race courses realise that. But back to that question, I mean, there's some great value and there's some very bad value. I mean, you know, I think it's, and there's, everybody's priced out of the game once they're even in the race course. You know, a lot of places, the absolute ridiculous amount of money they charge for drinks and food, the whole experience could be, you know, I think they should, all of it needs to be looked at, really.
Some people also say that there's too much racing, and that the fixture list in this country certainly is bloated. Would you reduce the amount of times basically that we raced a year?
Well, I think that it's probably, you know, the fact that I used to go to Kempton on a Wednesday night when I worked for Turf TV every Wednesday for like 8 years, and there's 14 runner races all night, you know, so there's obviously a demand for the amount of that sort of racing. I used to love it when the jump season ended and you had 2 or 3 months where you could get your time form books and you start doing your tender follows. I think it's never going to happen, I know, because of the all weather now, but I used to like the seasons that ended and then you had a gap and then everybody got excited about it next season again. You know, that's something I wish could come back, but I'm sure, you know, those days are gone. But that's what I would like to see.
Regarding the promotion of racing, a lot of people are wondering sort of where the sport's next generation of fans are, you know, sort of basically the Simon Knotts but in the 2020s. Do you worry that even if racing tries to promote itself better, that, you know, it might be more difficult to get young people into the game because there's more to do now? There's more competing sports, there's more competing leisure activities.
Well, there is a lot to do now, but if you look at who goes racing at weekends, the demographic is quite young. Midweek, the demographic's always going to be older because who can go midweek? Most people have got proper jobs. They work 9 to 5. Mm. You get tradesmen and people that can go during the week. The majority of people are always going to be pensioners or people of a certain age. Mm. Because that's when they've got their free time to go. So you're never going to get the race course full of 25-year-olds, you know, Monday to Friday.
Yeah.
But so I think to a certain extent, racing does a good job getting people in on the weekends, but and they're getting them in for the right reasons. Do they engage them in the racing? You know, we've all seen the fights. We all know about the, you know, people drinking and queues for the gents, cubicles in pairs. That's, you know, it's, there's that side of it, you know, is bad. But, you know, I think there's interest in racing, but whether people are actually interested enough in it. They go racing for a day out, but whether they're actually racing fans or not, and whether you, betting shops used to create racing fans. But now, betting shops aren't even like that anymore. You know, people go in there for other reasons. They don't go in there just to bet on horses. Our local betting shop, we used to have 10 to follow competitions. You know, you all have your favourite horses. It was like a little community. and nearly everyone that I knew back when I was 18 is still into racing now. You see them at Cheltenham, that sort of thing, you know. But I don't think racing used to, the betting shops used to pay back racing by creating fans, but I don't think they do anymore.
Regarding fans, racing is lucky to have a spot on terrestrial TV through ITV and in Ireland on RTE too. Do you feel that racing's well covered on TV? Because it used to be on the BBC, and we recently lost, well, symbolic terms, Cornelius Lycett from the commentary box. And do you think racing gets a good shake of things in the media?
Well, I think it's a bit of a worry with, you know, all the racing journalists that are now losing their jobs. Considering it is supposed to be the second most popular sport or attended sport, then I think these days it's being neglected, and I think that's because of gambling. You know, the stigma that's being now put onto gambling. I think ITV do very well. If they've got to a wide appeal, there's no point having a load of anoraks on there talking about speed figures and going, you know, talk about some of that stuff, but you've got to have a wide appeal. That's why they need to have, you know, celebrities on there. And, you know, I think they do a good job trying we've got two dedicated channels for absolute anoraks and real dedicated racing fans. So ITV's got to be what it is, which is, I think they do a good job. They've got some good characters on there. You know, anyone that just sort of tunes in could easily get interested in it. It's not dumbing it down. It's just, it is terrestrial TV to the entire country. So it's got to be a broad spectrum of interest for people that might just stumble upon it and then stay watching.
Thinking a bit more positively now about some of the stuff in racing now, what's the best innovation that you've seen in racing? Because we had Nathan Horrocks on, the inventor of the Steadicam. There's now, I think, a much more immersive racing experience, you know, not only with the TV coverage, but weird sort of new race maker programs, people were actually being educated and allowed to get much closer to the horses. Is there anything in particular you've seen that's a really positive thing that racing should run with?
I think the race maker thing's very good, but that's, you've got to get people racing to then meet a race maker. I think one of my interviewees said before, I think it was Josh Appiafi, you need to take racing into the communities. You need to go, because you go into inner city places, they're full of people, betting shops, you know, still full of people that are betting on the racing. They go and bet on the racing every day, but they wouldn't dream of going. And I think sometimes, once again, about, you know, all of us that are involved in it, people might feel a bit alienated, a bit daunted by the actual thought of going racing. Have you got the right clobber on? Yeah. Are you going to go to the right, you know, the right enclosure? You know, I think if you can take like a road show or something to the people that engage in it as far as betting goes, and then try and explain to them that it isn't as daunting as they might think, and that racing is accessible to everybody as an attendee, then that would be a good innovation.
Absolutely. And for those who are watching, I know that most of the people watching are seasoned anoraks, but for those who are watching who might not have had a chance to go racing as much as you, what's one course, away from the big grade one tracks, what's one course that you'd really recommend to take a first timer to, maybe?
Yeah, one of my favourites is Newton Abbot, because you can get the train down there from London. It's an absolutely fantastic journey down. You get the train from anywhere, you know, from Paddington downwards. People down in on holiday, if it's a bit miserable weather in Torquay or whatever, it's just a friendly track. It's quite often sunny because it races in the summer. Extremely friendly, extremely go ahead, try hard, independent owners that they really need to get people in there so they engage people. They have fantastic family fun days. I mean, me and my wife and daughter go in the last couple of years. They give you like the kids a special race car. It's fantastic. And you feel welcome when you go there. It's a welcoming place, which I think a lot of other race courses maybe aren't, for the reasons we talked about earlier.
And last but never least for this section, what's one racing trip abroad that, you know, we talked about the Melbourne Cup, which you'd love to do again. Is there any racing trip abroad that's on the Simon Knott bucket list?
Yeah, is another in Australia, Birdville. Apparently Birdville is in the middle of Queensland, and it's a town that's got 100 people living in it, and then once a year everybody descends on Birdland. Is it Birdland or Birdville? I can't remember there, but it's that is one play. It looks absolutely amazing, but I think it's probably a young man's game. You've got to sleep out, and there's, you know, that does look something special. Birdville, I'm pretty sure it's Birdville.
Right, Simon, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
So, back again with Simon Knott, of course, betting people legend, and we're going to ask you about a couple of your interviews. First of all, which interview have you ever conducted that really, really took you by surprise, that gave you something you weren't expecting? Okay.
Right, Andy Gibson. Now, he's a professional punter in Lancaster, and I went up there, you know, expecting to talk to a professional punter. When I came away, the train was heaving, it was raining, somebody was sat in my seat. Most of the things that I would have been annoyed about, because I had a long journey back to Devon, it was going to take me about 8 hours. But Andy Gibson, not only was he extremely interesting to talk to as a professional punter, but it's just such, the whole house radiated such happiness. I mean, he takes in refugees that have come across, you know, from war-torn countries, puts them up in his house, helps them out. And they, you know, there's people there, and I was meeting these people you never normally meet. Just everything about the whole experience, I went away feeling quite elated. At the plus side was the video was also very popular, still very popular. But that, that was just, I'd never expected that, and I came away with quite a different idea about things, you know. And just, it was just, I did a blog about it actually. I was so touched by it all. So that was the one that surprised me definitely.
Recently, of course, it's just in the background. You've got the book Rogue Trader by Nick Leeson. Of course, Nick Leeson, I think, will be a name familiar even to some non-racing fans who might happen to be watching this. What was your impression of him? Because, you know, to interview somebody who did that, what was it like?
He's a very, very nice chap. You know, he met me at the hotel where we arranged the meet, and sort of, yeah, just really nice, you know. Down, I don't know what I was expecting, really. I don't think I was expecting anything less than what he was. You know, he's very friendly down to earth. I mean, and he sort of really realises that he's notorious because he, what he did was, you know, was wrong, and, you know, he brought down a bank and stuff. But yeah, he was just, I think, like you said, he did his time, and he's now getting on with his life. Picked himself up. There was quite a backlash from various quarters on Twitter saying you shouldn't have interviewed somebody that was a criminal. But the thing was, what he did, he tried to cover up initially a mistake that was made on the trading floor, to cover up, you know, one of his members of staff, and things got out of hand. I mean, he wasn't stealing the money to put in his own pocket. He was trying to dig himself out, like probably a lot of gamblers have tried to do. You go in there and do a £20 each way snide 11-2 shot, which gets beat, and all of a sudden you're looking at, you can't pay the rent, and, you know, the nightmare scenario. And then all of a sudden the earthquake in the Asia then multiplied the, you know. So even though he didn't steal 80 million or whatever it was, he lost it on behalf of the firm. So it's not quite, you know, not quite the same as the great train robbers. So, you know, he was very interesting. It was nice to meet him.
Another interview recently that you've done, there was some controversy over comments that he made. And now, generally, you know, when you're interviewing somebody, what's it like to be on the other side when they say something that people pick up and run with? Because there were some people who were rather unhappy with what he said about, our current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. What was that like? Because it went a bit off-piste when it was talk about him and he started talking about politics. And I wonder, you know, from this side of the chair, what do you do when something like that goes catches fire, basically?
Well, Dave Yates was one of those, he is an outspoken character. So one of the reasons we're getting him on is because he was an outspoken character, and within reason people can say what they want. Now, Dave, he's sort of near the knuckle with what he said, but he was going on record as of it being his opinion. I did get a steward's inquiry from a few people that, you know, he shouldn't have been allowed to say what he said. He'd already said similar things on Twitter. And also the political part of it was very small, but he does write for the Daily Mirror, which is, you know, a confessed left-wing or left-wing leaning paper. So I thought that the from four parts, the 2 minutes that we talked about politics out of about 45 was probably justified, because, you know, and then he had a right to say his opinion. Then he's put himself out there, so a lot of people probably thought a lot less of him, and other people might have thought more of him, but I'm sure it was all tongue-in-cheek. You know, he didn't really mean literally what he was saying there, but that was Dave's interview, and I took the decision that Dave's interview was Dave's interview.
Thinking about 2020, you know, betting people, we've covered a lot of ground, I think it's fair to say. Is there anybody that you'd still think, gosh, I'd like to interview them? Is there anybody that we might expect you to be chasing after Christmas?
Well, there is the one absolute big one, which is Barney Curley. I mean, I've been in contact with Barney. I've spoken to him a few times. A few times I thought I was definitely going to be there. But I did get to go and have a cup of tea with him in Newmarket this summer. And he sort of left slightly that I might be in with a chance. He's the one, he's been my hero since I first got interested in racing. So he was my dream interviewee, Barney.
Did you get on any of his gambles? Did you get on the, there was a huge one at, wasn't it Kempton?
I was there when, and I wrote a blog, the blog's still online now, and there was a couple of lads that did spot it, or they thought they spotted it, and they won about 60 grand, and they were in the stands, and it was very sparse at Kempton, as it often is, and they were absolutely roaring at home. I think one of the guys ended up working for Channel 4, not because of that, but he ended up there, and that was, you know, but you got to have huge respect and admiration for somebody that can put together a gamble like that. Still not officially admitted it was him, by the way, is he? But, you know, horses haven't seen a racecourse for years, a couple of years or whatever, you know. And to get four on the same day, and to get them all ready, and to get them all to win, and get the money on,
yeah,
pretty amazing. I mean, you know, it take your hat off to him. I do, anyway.
There's been a lot of legendary gamblers on this list, Andy Gibson, Barney Curley. If you could give, apart from those two, who is the other big punter that, you know, you really respect as a big name? Because there are quite a few on the list of betting people that we've done.
Well, not punter, but bookmaker was Stephen Little. Now, Stephen has got to be the most successful independent on-course bookmaker of recent years in living memory. I mean, he started off working as a floorman, riding to the races on a push bike, and people up until the turn of the century will remember him turning up in his Bentley, in his musquat coat, take £100,000 bets on the rails back in the, you know, in the 90s from punters, and he now lives in a, well, he calls it a terraced house, but where he lives in Bath is quite amazing. And, you know, he managed to keep the money, and he was still owed fortunes apparently when he turned it in. But he's a fascinating character, and I was really pleased to be able to interview him. I'm sure there's lots he didn't tell me still. He'd be good for a part two, but he's a very, you know, high on my admiration list.
With betting people interviews, so what's your favourite thing actually about doing them? Because you've had such an extensive list, and there's been so many. Each person I speak to, and when I was doing prep for this, each person I spoke to, they had their favourite. What's your favourite thing about the whole experience, about interviewing?
Well, I've thoroughly enjoy it, because I've been in racing, you know, for a long time now. When you're working in the betting ring, you are seeing the same people, most of the same people, nearly every day. You're in the betting ring. When you get there, you're in there. Oh. You don't, unless you're the boss, you don't really get to go around in the paddock. You don't meet anybody apart from the nucleus that is in the betting ring. So for 20 odd years, half the time, I didn't even know what a trainer looked like, because you weren't watching it on the TV, because you're always at racing, you know. And then when I worked for Turf TV, you're returning SPs, but you're in that little box, you're in the press room. So even though you're involved with this sport, it's still quite insular. So you're doing two insular things. Now, it's absolutely fantastic, because I'm getting to meet a whole range of people in the sport that I've been in for a long time, and all different walks of life. People, you know, I interviewed Peter Phillips, the Queen's grandson. I mean, I never thought I'd be interviewing him. Professional punters I'd never heard of that turned out to be hugely, you know, sort of inspirational people. just thoroughly enjoying the whole experience, and hopefully we can keep, there's so many that refuse to do it, so many that want to stay under the radar, that, you know, we keep chipping away and keep trying to get them, but there's so many interesting people out there with a story to tell, and you know, hopefully we've got plenty more years of it yet.
From the racing media, what other interviewers do you really enjoy watching work?
Well, I mean, after I'd started doing this, you realise how brilliant Nick Luck is.
Mm.
To be able to do 2.5-3 hours of live TV with, as far as I can tell, minimal notes, and just seamlessly, you know, my admiration for him is massive since I've been, always respected him anyway, but since I've been doing this, it shows what talent, you know, anybody that can do live TV like that, interviewing people, is pretty astonishing, really.
I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.